all the way since April, since we've really been meeting, so going to have a little overview today on getting started with the bonding bill proposals. But first I'd like to welcome back our staff as well as our members and introduce a couple of people. Let's see, we have a committee page, new committee page. John Murth, right back here.
Hello.
Welcome, John.
Good.
And let's see. We'll have some, as other new staff people that are going to be here assisting us, will be here later in the week. We'll introduce them at that time. The remainder, I want to have a reminder for people with regard to the coffee that it's available for everyone. And so make yourselves at home there and grab yourself a cup of coffee. Donations are welcome, but certainly not necessary. The Robert Freeman is also our committee legislative assistant, who's new to the committee. He's been working with us a good portion of the, well, since, when did you join us, Robert? November? So we're starting to get, kind of at ease and comfortable with our new changes, and those things are going right along very well for us right now. See, the committee business, we're going to have hearings for the next several days, focus on the agency capital and budget projects, the capital investment projects, and they we're going to submit. We also want to remind members with regard to your bills. If you're going to have hearing requests, make sure you get those hearing requests in as quickly as you can so that we can start to schedule out what's going to happen. We're going to really try to move things right along this year. We're going to start off with our capital investment overviews, but then get right into our bills as quickly as we can and get our work done. So the don't forget to do that. If you're going to, if you have any concerns or want timing as to what's happening or help with putting together your testifiers and so forth, please work with Marilyn Brick, committee administrator, and she'll help you line it up. The first thing we have on the agenda are the minutes, approval of the minutes. And Representative Hoppe, did you have a chance to look at those?
I did. They were very nice.
Okay. Representative Hoppe moves approval of the April 16th minutes. Any questions, concerns? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. And we also have the April 23rd minutes. Anyone else have a chance to look at them? Representative Cornish?
Yes, I did.
Representative Cornish moves approval of the April 23rd minutes. Any questions or concerns? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. Okay. I think that we are about ready to go. Is Mr. Reinholz? Ah, there he is, the gentleman of the moment. We're ready for you, Jim. Mr. Reinholz will give us a brief overview of the capital budget recommendations. The information is in your folder. We also have a three-ring binders that contain the agency information. Please add to it as appropriate as you receive information from the agency presentations. So, Mr. Reinholz.
Mr. Chairman, members, I believe what you have before you is the folded three-ring binder, and I'm not sure how much the chairman gave you information on this, but this is the governor's budget as submitted by the Department of Finance for the environmental agencies. Those are the PCA, the DNR, the OEA, Bowser, the zoo. Also contains the Met Parks request for capital budget that goes through this committee. And probably there may be some other programs added, specifically PFA programs, that they some water programs, funding for wastewater treatment and water treatment that do come before this agency or this committee, and also before the Economic Development Committee. I believe, I'm not sure if you would, that we have Bowser here today to testify, but I had told the chair that I would go quickly through one of the examples in here so that the committee understood maybe a little bit how to read the book. There's a lot of detail in here, most of which you won't want to know, so if that's what you'd like me to do, Mr. Sure. Chairman, I could do that.
That sounds good.
If members, I'll just, you know, I could use the Bowser one since they are here today. If you turn to your tab for the Board of Water and Soil Resources. You found that the book is organized, no matter what agency it is, organized in the same manner. It starts out with, as you can see up in the right corner, it's called the Project Funding Summary. What this page lists is all the requests that the governor, the agency has had and the governor is recommending. In this case, Bowser had made three requests for capital budget programs to the governor: the Rim Reserve, the local government road, the stream bank, the lakeshore and roadside erosion control. It also lists the priority that the agency made on those requests. They have been, the programs are then listed in that priority. You can see number one was the Rim Reserve. The next item is a strategic score. That's kind of a technical system that's been set up by the Department of Finance to try to put some ranking numbers behind it. I won't go into that. If you're interested in that, you could find that either. I could get you that information on how that's reached, or you can go out on the Department of Finance webpage also and find it. The next column shows where the funding comes from. General fund, GF is general fund, GO is general obligation bonding. In this case, there's some general fund requests. There's also primarily the bonding, the items that are normally dealt with in this capital budget are bonding. Then the dollar amounts listed as requested by the agency for this year and the next 2 year cycles. We show an outward 6 years. Then it shows also the governor's request to the legislature. So we have both the agency request and the governor's request in front of us. In this case, you can see that for 2004, the agency was looking for $32,822,000. The governor's request is $26,362,000. As always, all these numbers have three more zeros that you have to put behind them. So you can see the governor recommended the majority, but not all of this. That's just the summary page. If you move on then through the Bowser, what you see next is what's called an agency profile. This will be just some real overview of the agency. I would say in most cases the committee is pretty well aware of what the agency is and what they do, but you may want to look at some of that at some point in time just to see how they list what they think is important. Moving on to the next section, you can see up in the right, it's called the Strategic Planning Summary. What this is supposed to be is a little bit more keyed into what they think that ties into bonding in their planning. And if you read through that, you would see that most of it is talking about Rim Reserve, and that's where they had their highest priority. You can move through that, and it does then give you some detail on the other bonding items they have, wetlands transportation, and then also just some overview of the agency once again, and is really their plan going forward. If you move on to the next page, I'm on to page 7 then, in the Bowser section. Up in the top, it's called Project Narrative. This now is going into a smaller piece. This is going into the Rim Reserve Program and CREP request. You can see there's where the agency, on the first page on the left column, the agency looked for $23,200,000. It was their number one priority. We saw that back on the summary page, and I won't get into trying to explain this. I think that's what Mr. Harnack is here for today, and he'll get into that. But this is the written explanation of their request. If you move through it, you can see the kind of information they have there is how many acres they'll do. Moving on to page 9, there's some information that's important, like previous appropriations for this. You can see in 90. On the right-hand column on page 9, in 1996, the first appropriation for this, $11 million. There's been $15 million, $21 million, and a large one
in 4 years ago in 01 of $51 million. So it's giving you some information on the past. Moving through it again, is this down at the last page, on page 10, what you really see here is the governor's recommendation. That's where you see the governor's recommending $20 million for this project and the little narrative that he has there. Then you're moving into the numbers detail on page 11 for this one request, the CREP program. What you see mostly is a period of going out once again over three cycles, also a prior year column, so you can see how much money we've spent in the past on this program, where the money's come from. In this case, we've showed that in prior years, $246,389,000 have been spent on this. You can see the breakdown of where that money has come from. The majority of it has come from federal funds, $163 million, and you also see the state funding, $83 million. And where that state funding has come from is a combination of bonding and the general fund appropriations. You see the request that the agency has moving forward in years. That goes out over the six-year cycle. Going down to the last chart, what you see down there is an estimate of operating costs changes to the agency. This is often important and often overlooked by committees as they pass bonding. This is designed to tell you that if you do this bonding request, the agency is going to tell you either in this year's request or when they come before the committee next year in the regular funding cycle that they need more operating money. So I recommend that you look at that and ask questions of the agencies as they come forth as to how they made those estimates if you have questions. In this case, you can see that the agency for 04 and 05 is looking for $3.2 million worth of estimated expenditures if this bonding program goes through. Over on the right column over there is some really a little bit more technical. It tells you where the money's coming from, and then there's some yes and no's, really are technical things that come up in statutory questions people ask. You move on to page 12. What that is giving you how that, I told you each one of these projects is scored. It gives you a little bit of a breakout on how that score was arrived at. In this case, you can see that the largest part of the 420 points it was given is because the agency rated it as number one was 100, and it also is links closely to their six-year plan, which is one of the items finance looks at. If you have questions on how that was arrived at, you could easily ask me, or you could ask the agency if you wonder. That's how the book's laid out, and I think I just wanted to go quick through so you can see what the agency's coming forth, what kind of information's been presented to you. Each one of the projects then has the same type of information. Each agency follows the same format. There's an agency summary, and then it goes down into details on the project.
Any questions on the layout of the book? Okay, Mr. Reynolds, general fund and general obligation bonds. There I also see that there is acronyms here for other funding sources and user finance bonding. Do we get into any of those?
Mr. Chairman, there are bonding in this committee that is user finance. I'm trying to remember if there are any right now. The Ag Department, the RFA program is user finance. Sometimes things like snowmobile trails will be user financed. I don't believe there was any requests in this year's budget from the governor that has user financing in the environmental area, though. There oftentimes are sometimes in the DNR there are projects that are funded through some of the dedicated funds.
Well, when we see user financed, will be generally that will be relating to some fees or some type of license fees or whatever.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Fees, or in some cases, they're loans where the individual or that receives the loan does pay it back.
Yeah. Okay, any other questions? Thank you very much. We will now go to Mr. Harnack with the Board of Soil and Water Resources. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ron Hernick, the director with the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. And it's good to be here. All the snow and everything else we got. Snowshoeing is great out in the countryside. What I'd like to do briefly this morning is to talk about two of our capital budget proposals that the governor has recommended for funding. We have handed out a copy of our PowerPoint presentation that also has the ability for you to make some notes along the side of that. If you have any questions as we go along, please interrupt me and let me know. The two requests that we have before you, Mr. Chairman and members, is local government wetland road replacement for $4.3 million and rim reserve / CREP, because it is a partnership and the state side of it is funded through Rim Reserve. First of all, I'd like to review the wetland road replacement program. As many of you know, the wetland issue has been a rather controversial one in various aspects since 1991, when the Wetland Conservation Act was passed. And one of the major issues that evolved during that discussion was public roads, particularly the maintenance and repair and safety improvements of public roads, and where the obligation for funding the mitigation should fall. As part of the discussions through that debate, there was agreement that the state, through Bowser's appropriations, would fund the mitigation for local roads, and that statutory obligation is under 103G 222. It basically says that the state will provide the mitigation for those local public roads, counties, towns, and cities. Consistent with the Wetland Conservation Act, in parts of the state it's a 1-to-1, in other parts of the state it's 2-to-1. The obligation to meet those on a biennial basis is $4.362 million. We have some agreements with the Corps of Engineers, the Department of Natural Resources, the regulatory agencies that have an impact over wetlands, that we all agree to the same mitigation strategies that makes it highly efficient for the local units of government as we go through, as they have to go through that process. The annual wetland mitigation needs over the past 2 years has been 225 acres, and that's the basis for our proposal. The average cost to date for the metro area is about $15,000 per acre, and I would suggest that that probably is going to be low as we move forward. In the metro area, trying to find the mitigation sites, drained wetlands in particular, give us the biggest bang for our investment. The average cost outstate or non-metro areas is $6,000 per acre. If you look at breaking down that 225 acres, and I think this is a significant distribution when you look at the capacity for local governments to pay for some of this. 108 acres of that is township obligations, 34 acres of that is city, and 83 acres of that is county obligations. And so when you look at the ability to address those issues, certainly townships are at some of the greatest risks. Historically, since the Wetland Conservation Act was passed, this graphic shows the wetland replacement needs in the kind of the shaded circles, and the open circles are areas where we have already projects in place for wetland banking credits that have been constructed through wetland restorations around the state. You can see certainly in the northeast, the wetland impacts are greater, but that's just the nature of the geography of the state, where there's more wetlands in those areas. And in the kind of the prairie pothole area of the state, it's certainly a lot less, because there are less wetlands that are remaining in those areas. The dark lines show the fact that if you're in the northeast or in an area where more than 80% of the wetlands still exist, the wetland replacement is 1-to-1. Outside of that area, the wetland replacement is 2-to-1. Last year, there was quite a bit of discussion before the legislature over this issue of wetland replacement and some other relationships with local units of government. But the cost in the metro area, and there was an amendment that was passed by the legislature regarding wetland replacement siting in the metro area. And what it sustains is a 2-to-1 mitigation, but it sets up a hierarchical sequencing for replacement in the metro area. If you lose an acre, it has to be replaced in the affected county first, in another county in the metro area, or in one of the major watersheds that are wholly or partially within the seven-county metropolitan area. But at least one of the 2-to-1 must be within the geographic area of the seven county. But what this does is allows the second area to be replaced within the context of these watersheds that you see on this graphic. What that will have a tendency to do is help the state costs, and I think will help us do a better job of mitigating, yet still impacting water quality, water quantity issues related to the metropolitan area. The program benefits are streamlining the project approval process, particularly with the agreements that Bowser has with the Corps of Engineers and DNR. We don't have to squabble over whether mitigation is adequate or inadequate. We have everybody on the same wavelength. It's much more cost effective. In the past, if local units of government had to do it by themselves, you'd basically be digging out a little bit of the wetland on the fringe or using some potential ditch area to be the mitigation. It's certainly higher cost when they have to do that. Plus you don't get as good a wetland. Here we can go out and restore a comprehensive diversity of wetlands to meet that demand, and works out well for everyone. We talked historically about some of the implications of not funding this, and that was some of the discussions from last year. You have delayed or reduced completion of the local public roads projects, because there are a number of projects that have already been approved, and the mitigation takes place after those projects have been approved. It's one unique aspect of our relationship with the public road systems is everybody else has to do their mitigation concurrently or in advance. But under the relationship we have with the public road systems, they report to us annually, and then we do the mitigation subsequent to it. So if there was no funding, it really puts those projects in jeopardy, because it doesn't mean they wouldn't have to mitigate, but the federal government would require them to do it on a case-by-case basis individually, which isn't a very good way to go when you're looking at cost-effectiveness and the effectiveness of wetland mitigation as well. As I indicated before, the program is statutory. It will cost us $4.362 million for the next 2 years. We believe it is a very cost-effective and efficient way to approach mitigation. We have entered into a collaborative agreement with the Department of Transportation, although they do their mitigation separately, to do a combined approach to mitigation. And I think we can be even more efficient that way in our our wetland approach by marrying up with DOT along with the local road mitigation aspects that we're doing. It's critical for the county, city, and township road authorities to have a significant impact if it were not approved. And we do our best to try to optimize other water management goals, whether it be water quality, flood control, wildlife, greenways, and do a fairly good job of, I think, partnering in that way. The Bowser is not an agency that manages land long term, so in many instances what we are doing is once these sites have been acquired, they are transferred to the Department of Natural Resources as a wildlife management area, and I think that broadens the public benefit and the public value overall related to the program. So, Mr. Chairman, if there are some specific questions regarding the Wetland Road Replacement Program, I'd be happy to answer those now before I go on to the CREP initiative.
Any questions? Representative Tinklestad.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Harnack, your last comment about moving those areas where you've done the mitigation to forgive my acronyms here, so WMAs, how many of those have been done through the years, or do you have some kind of totals on those numbers?
Let me see, I can, we have one site this summer that is located up in the northwest, that large open circle, that's a complex of about 25 different wetland types distributed over a parcel there. That this summer will be transferred to the DNR as a WMA. We have another one down in Scott County, which I believe has been transferred to the Department of Natural Resources as a WMA. And we do have a couple others. There's one up in Aiken County as well that we're looking at doing the same thing on.
So, Mr. Chair, just to follow up, so through the year, it was 1996 the first time you did that, and what's the total of all those numbers?
That's a good question, Mr. Chairman, Representative. I don't have that total number right in front of me, but I can get that for you.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Other questions? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Harnack, I have just a comment or a question. In the past, when we haven't been as flexible in the two-for-one acreage, and now you're reaching out a little farther, are we going to have less incidences of where we're doing this wetland mitigation and they don't hold water and they're not wetlands? We actually, I mean, I can think of a few specific instances where we weren't able to reach out and be more flexible. I see now we're reaching out. And I just hope that when we do this wetland mitigation in the future that we're going to really end up with wetlands.
Mr. Chairman and Representative McNamara, if I look back at some of the early mitigation that we did, you know, in 91, 92, in those early years, you know, there are some wetlands that probably were not what I'd call the highest quality. But in the last 5 years, we'll put our wetland restorations under this program up against any. We feel that they've been very excellent wetland restorations. Now, some folks would like to see water in them all the time, but part of the thing we're attempting to do is to mitigate type for type where practical. And a lot of the losses are the fringe of wetlands, which are your type 1s, type 2s, or your shrub wetlands, your type 6s. And we do our best to try and ensure that the replacement correlates with the losses the best that we can. And we're able to do that better when we're doing a complex of wetlands. We've got one currently that we're trying to partner up with Dakota County, the Trust for Public Lands, and DNR, I believe, on an area, I think it's tributary to the Vermilion River, on a wetland. And that would probably be like a type 2 wetland. It's not going to have a lot of water that you're going to see standing on it, but it is going to be a saturated condition, and that area is currently currently farmed, and we'll be able to get about 120 acres worth of banking credits off of it if that goes forward.
Other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Let's go to the next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next is the Rim Reserve Program, and I have Kevin Lyons, who's our easement coordinator, sitting with me here. If some specific questions come up relating to the program. But a little history of it. The Rim Reserve Program was established in 1986 as an outgrowth of a report to the legislature on natural resources recommending a number of different facets to enhance natural resources in the state of Minnesota. It is the cornerstone of Bowser's easement program and basically compensates landowners for granting a conservation easement and protects or retires marginal cropland and environmentally sensitive agricultural lands. Lands are enrolled or managed under a conservation plan, which generally includes wetland restorations, native grass plantings, and tree plantings. Environmentally sensitive lands are lands that are at risk to groundwater contamination, such as wellhead protection, sinkholes. Those are of particular importance in the southeast. Riparian lands, waterways, drainage systems, rivers and streams, and wetland restorations fall under that category. When we're looking at marginal croplands, excuse me, we're looking at lands that are highly erodible, flood prone, and have other limitations related to cropping, whether it's high groundwater, rock outcrops, and so forth. Over the years, since the establishment of the program, the state has established about 180,000 acres, 4,700 easements statewide. You can see most of those occur in the Minnesota River Basin, and that's primarily because of the past Minnesota River CREP, which resulted in 100,000 acres within that area. And you can kind of see from, if we went to a county-sized map, you'd begin to see the linear orientation of a lot of these easements as they occur along the rivers and streams and ditches within those particular areas. The benefits of the Rim Reserve Program are severalfold. The program was established primarily for water quality and habitat, and at that time, habitat was one of the key and foremost factors. But water quality now is an evolving issue with impaired waters and TMDLs being established. Certainly, Rim Reserve can be a significant contributor to reducing phosphorus, nitrogen, and sediment. It can also be a significant contributor to reducing flood damages, protecting public water supplies, and incidental to that is certainly creating significant wildlife habitat. Economic benefits, reducing disaster assistance, crop insurance payments, a significant enhancement for recreation and tourism throughout the state. The program is locally prioritized and implemented through the Soil and Water Conservation Districts and through the county water plans that prioritize areas of importance for the local units of government. We've been good at being able to leverage federal and private funds, particularly through the federal government, USDA, Farm Bill programs, whether it's CRP or WRP, the Wetland Reserve Program, and certainly the private groups, particularly Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, Minnesota Waterfowl Association, and some of our partner agencies, PCA and DNR, have been active participants in it as well. The environmental benefits, one advantage that we have is for every easement that's taken, the local unit of government is able to determine through a predetermined formula based on soil type and slope and what have you, the estimated amount of soil loss reduction, sediment reduction, and phosphorus reduction in pounds per year. And this gives a perspective of what that has been from 1998 through 2002 reporting system that we have in place. The subsequent photos or graphics that you see here, how some of that is distributed throughout the state, and is a direct reflection of the number of easements that have been put in place in these counties. The darker lines represent the major river basins for the state. And this one shows sediment reduction, which is what is transported to the surface waters of our river streams and lakes. You're all familiar with the Minnesota River CREP, which was the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program. Minnesota was the second state to employ a CREP program. It was prior to any of the major policies and rules and regulations being in place. Minnesota received approval for 100,000 acres, and we have completed that goal of 100,000 acres. The leveraging at that time, just a little bit of reflection on it, was $81 million of state contribution, $160 million federal, which is basically a 40-60 relationship. The new rules under CREP provide for a 20-80 contribution, which is a significant advantage of leveraging for the state. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, since I think one of the things that we're very interested in these programs is what the outcomes of them are, and so I'm interested in those two previous slides on the phosphorus reduction and the sediment reduction. So how are those estimates made?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, what we did is, in cooperation with the Pollution Control Agency and the University of Minnesota, we developed a formula-based approach with diverse factors in it. And when a local unit of government takes a parcel of land into the program, they input certain factors, and that model then spits out a estimate of what the phosphorus reduction and sediment reduction would be. Ultimately, with the other monitoring that takes place, we should be able to correlate kind of the site by site, ultimately, with, say, at the mouth of some of the tributaries, the reduction that you see on a longer term basis. In traditional monitoring like this, you're not typically going to see that instantaneous response at some point on the tributary or the main stem of, say, like the Minnesota River. It takes some time for that system to kind of acclimate to it.
Mr. Chairman, is there any mechanism, you know, I understand how you don't see the big results right away, but is there any mechanism for testing the model, for knowing that the model works or is...
Mr. Chairman and Representative, on a couple of clean water partnerships that PACA has had, I think in the Redwood Cottonwood, we've been able to verify some of those numbers that our relationships are reasonably close. I think that continued monitoring will give us a better perspective of that, and we're certainly looking at ways to improve our estimates as we move forward.
Representative Kenyas.
Thank you. Representative Kahn brought up a question that I was going to bring up later, but now that we're talking about it, I think I need to follow up. you have these environmental benefits of total soil loss and sediment and et cetera. It's all done in pounds, but we have no context. So out of how many pounds out there, is this 1%? Is it 10%? Is it 0.5%? So we need that context in order to see if this is significant for our waters. I have no question that CREP is wonderful for habitat, but arguing that it solves a significant part of our water problem may be a big reach right now, because I don't see that we can show that. But so I would like to know, out of what sediment, and I'm quite sure you don't have the numbers now, but right, if you could bring to us those numbers, out of what context? The same would be true for your phosphorus reduction and also. Out of how much is there?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Guineas, we can provide you some additional information on that. I think as the impaired waters moves forward, and particularly the establishment of TMDLs, which begins to get at some very specific elements, parameters that need to be reduced, some of those relationships become much, much clearer. But in a general way, we know, like in the Minnesota River, what some of those issues are, and in the southeast as well, and can give you a perspective of what the current erosion is and sedimentation is in comparison to this.
Mr. Chairman, if I follow up?
Representative Guineas.
I think the last time we chatted, we hadn't, with CREP in the Minnesota River Basin, we hadn't seen any improvement overall in water monitoring, if I remember correctly. And you're saying we have to wait a while to see if we're going to have water improvement from this. Do you have built into your funding water monitoring, monies for water monitoring? Because we don't have it. PCA doesn't have it. It has such limited water monitoring right now. And we just don't have water monitoring in the state. So are you building into this water monitoring so we can check on what we're doing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guineas, we do not have that built into here. We work with the Pollution Control Agency and the other agencies to utilize their monitoring to be able to assess back and make a determination here.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Guineas.
I hope this committee can, since PCA has such a limited ability to monitor, that we can do a check on this program as we go forward by using some of this CREP money to monitor what we're actually accomplishing. And I think that's a discussion for later, but I hope that that's on the table.
Okay. Mr. Harnack.
Mr. Chairman and members, the second generation CREP. As most of you know, all the emphasis for Rim Reserve and CREP was in the Minnesota River the last 5 years. The program provides some significant leveraging and great opportunities, particularly when we're in fiscally strapped times in particular. Three areas over the past 2 years, through local interest organizations and groups, have put together three individual proposals for CREP. The Red River Valley, 100,000 acres, the Southwest, 30,000 acres, and the Southeast, 95,730 acres, for a total of about 225,000 acres. USDA, through the CREP guidelines, basically will limit a CREP to 100,000 acres per state under each application proposal. So these three proposals were brought forward and for consideration into the proposal. The governor, having to make a decision on how this would be allocated or distributed or pick one and leave the others for future, the governor held public meetings in each of these areas, kind of listening sessions, to hear the proposals and get perspectives from the citizens, local governments, various interest organizations. The governor heard from a number of different folks, individual farmers, farm organizations, conservation groups, environmental organizations, water supply authorities, and other unaffiliated citizens, just people who had an interest. After deliberation on those listening sessions, the governor did make an announcement that all three areas would be included in the proposal to USDA. And the factors that led into that is that each one had a unique aspect that it was trying to address, whether it was water quality, whether it was public water supply, whether it was flood damage reduction. Each one had a unique aspect. In the governor's letter to USDA, the governor said that, "I am convinced that if we are going to sustain both our strong agricultural economy and our delicate natural resources, we need to develop partnerships which can address federal, state, and local objectives, priorities simultaneously." The governor then went out and made announcements in each one of the three areas, visiting on sites of specific projects in these areas. The details of the governor's application is 100,000 acres with a distribution in the three areas: the Red River, 42,500, the Southeast, 42,500, and the Southwest, 15,000. The proposal provides for a 15-year contract from USDA with a 35-year or perpetual rim reserve easement at the discretion of the landowner. Wetland restorations by statute are required to be permanent. The land types that are eligible in these vary from each one of these areas, but riparian zones and wetland restorations were a priority in the Northwest, or the Red River Valley. Highly erodible land and groundwater and wellhead protection were priorities in the Southeast and Southwest. And then we had a unique aspect of trying to put grass back in rotation, since we've lost a lot of our animal agriculture, particularly our dairy, in areas of the Southwest or Southeast, to try to put those back in. The benefits: the program focused strictly on water quality improvements, flood damage reductions, and certainly wildlife habitat.
Representative Wiginius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Here, I appreciate your detail in saying that the 42,000 acres of the Red River Valley is 0.53% of the cropland there. That detail is somewhat helpful in giving us a context, but it would be more helpful if we knew how much land, cropland along rivers, that we had, and how, what percentage this was of all of that cropland. Again, we have no context from which to judge whether what we're doing is significant, whether we have to kind of put our put ourselves to the grindstone to do more or what. We just have no context here. But if you could bring that at your next time that you visit with us, I think that would be helpful. So we have a context here.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative McGinnis, we'll see what we have in that area. There is some greater detail in the individual applications from these areas originally and how they prioritized and detailed those, and we may be able to get that information out of that.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, if I could follow up.
Representative McGinnis.
I'm not looking specifically at just these three rivers. We have lots of rivers in Minnesota. We have lots of erodible cropland next to these rivers. Out of all of the problem that we have in Minnesota, how much are we solving with this proposal? And that will give us an idea of how much more work we have to do, how much of a problem we are solving. If this is the best way to solve the problem, we need to know how to go forward and solve the rest of it, or if there are other things we need to do. So I know you won't have those numbers here, but I do think that we need a context.
That's good. Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, we do have that information. I don't have it here with me today, but we have estimated as part of the RIM Reserve strategic plan that there's 2.5 million acres out of the 23 million acres of cropland need to be targeted for some type of retirement programs. There's certainly other of those ag lands that require best management practices, and we can summarize the information that we have on that from our strategic plan. I'll see that you get that.
Mr. Chairman, if I could follow up.
So
if I understood you right, we have 2.5 million acres of cropland that you know that need to be targeted along the rivers all over the state.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, said not only the buffers but also wetland restorations. We've estimated that those are lands that should not be cropped and should be set aside because of their sensitivity or criticalness to erosion or sedimentation.
Okay, and we're going to be doing 100,000 this year, so you can come back to us with some good percentages, I can see.
Yes, but we had, when we laid out our strategic plan, we'd laid it out, I think, on a 15 or 20 year schedule to show that it's just not a black hole. You continue to throw money down, but our objective is to hit a very critical component using this program. And I think those numbers are still reasonably valid today.
Sounds like it's a 25-year plan to me, if my math is correct.
It depends on the funding strategy. Mr. Chairman, the other aspect I should mention in this is that in the CREP proposal, there is a unique aspect in northwestern Minnesota. We have six counties, approximately, that are at their set-aside through CRP, or in particular, at their 25% of their cropland. And one of the objectives we've asked USDA to is to give us some flexibility to either allow landowners to get out of that current contract without penalty, or to be able to extend it under this CREP agreement so that we can take advantage of those funds as part of the flood damage reduction strategies in the Red River Valley. And again, that's a decision that USDA would have to make.
Representative Bennis.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Harnack, two questions. First of all, clear me up on, are all RIM easements perpetual? And then I have a second.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and Representative Pennis. No, they are not. The program provides anywhere from a 20-year easement to perpetual. Wetland restorations are required by law to be permanent. And then there's another provision in the law that says the agency shall give preference to permanent easements where there's a continuing demand. Part of the negotiations with USDA here is to find a reasonable balance on those that can be acceptable to move forward with.
And then my second question is in the some of the counties in the northwest part of the state, it would be advantageous to know, in talking about percentages, what percentage of the county already is in either WMA state land or conservancy land, if you could get that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pennis, I believe that we probably have the ability to do that, including the CRP land and all the conservation land that exists in the counties. I believe we've got a listing that does that, and we can provide that for the committee.
Thank you.
Mr. Harnack, on the previous slide, it was you're showing the this is going to work in conjunction with CRP, and it's my understanding that that means that the land needed to be cropped in the recent past,
yes,
in order to be eligible. How does that play out when we're talking about wetland protection, which wouldn't be cropped in the first place if it still is a wetland, and the with regard to highly erodible lands, which may be the wooded lands that are right along the shore, river banks and lake shore. How does that cropping requirement coordinate with that?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, and that's been a little bit of a moving target in the Minnesota River. I believe the requirement for the CRP side of it was to be cropped two of the last 5 years. Under the new farm bill, it's cropped four out of the last six. So if you have a situation, and a good example is there are some ditches around the state where there is already a small buffer, say a one rod buffer, but it's certainly not sufficient to address the water quality issues associated with it. When a CREP easement then is taken, it starts outside of that current vegetative strip and goes beyond it. So, and CRP would not, and CREP would not be eligible for that strip area. Or if it was on another stream where you had a small buffer of wooded fringe and crop outside of that, and you still needed a buffer there to meet your water quality needs, you would not be able to include those currently wooded lands as part of the CREP initiative.
You cannot include them.
You cannot.
That really cuts down as to what I envisioned CREP was going to be able to do in the form of prevention, because essentially those wooded lands have to be actually developed, forested or whatever, before they become eligible. Is that correct?
Under the CREP initiative, unless they had that cropping history, they would not be able to be included in the CREP.
Is that because of federal requirements, or is that because of the way the state application was put together?
That's a federal requirement.
So really, CREP is just an enhanced CRP program.
It is a... Yes, I would say it is an enhanced CRP program, similar to what RIM Reserve is, straight out. And the advantages is we get prioritization, better targeting, and the real core of the program was more restoration, in fact, than it was necessarily protection.
Yeah. Representative Buginius, I think you had a
question. Thank you. Good question, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'm sitting here puzzling. You had said that you wanted to lay out a program where there was a time certain that we could end, and you were looking at 15 years. And I look at the need
and it's spread out over 25 years, I mean, that's my rough math, and y'all go back and do it right if that's wrong. But then, if we have easements that are only 20 years, we're going to keep coming back and doing again and again. So we may have a perpetual program rather than a program with a time certain in. And I think we have to understand how much of this job can be finished, and we can say, we've finished that job. Or are we going to be doing this year after year after year for my children and my grandchildren to do too?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guarnias, I guess from my perspective, we're not in it to pay and pay and pay again. We're in it for a one-shot deal and to leverage the optimum that we can through the federal government so that we can keep that time frame, whether it's 25 or 20 years, to keep shrinking that and leveraging. I've also got a lot of optimism as we look out across the countryside and look at the local water plans and the watersheds that are out there and the local units of government and landowners, that if we have some of the easements in for 50 years, that the likelihood of them ever coming back out, because we hope that it is also going to work towards preventing areas from being put on impaired waters lists and help waters come off an impaired waters list. And therefore, the risk to landowners and local governments and the rest of the public is that those areas should probably not come out. And part of it, I think, is a stewardship ethic that people have, that this program helps get them in the front door, and then long term, beyond that 50-year period, if they aren't permanent, I think they will likely be sustained.
Representative Guinea.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think maybe this, I mean, with computers today, we can just lay this all out. I don't know how many 50-year easements there are compared to how many 20-year easements there are. So without that, I have hopes, the same hopes that you do, but I would like to see how much of this is in 20-year easements, how much is in 50-year easements, and how many times we may have to redo this.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Guinness, I can tell you on that, if you looked at that 178,800 acres, there are none. There may be two or three out there, but there are very few that are 20 year or less. Now, we in the Minnesota River, we had, I think, 1% that was less than permanent. But the vast majority of everything that we've taken have been permanent easements.
Representative Guinness.
Thank you. I mean, if that is the case and we can carry that forward, we will be able to see, is it going to be 25 years, is it going to be 35 years or whatever. But if we change and say, well, we can have shorter easements, that's going to mean taxpayers are going to have to do a lot more investing. So, but it'd be good to get that back from you. Thank you.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, following up on your previous questions about the issue of prevention, would it, I know the attractiveness of CREP is, of course, the federal funding match, but should we rethink about how much money we're going to put into RIM instead? Because RIM doesn't have that. RIM would do much more of what the chairman said ought to be our higher priority, which is getting those lands that we want to make sure don't turn to crop land. I mean, it would be really terrible to take out lands that at one were probably more suited to crop land than the others. So we take those out with a permanent easement and then encourage people to cut down. And I hope filling wetlands is hard enough so that, or cropping wetlands is hard enough so that that won't get done. But, you know, cutting down woodlands would be a really bad effect of doing this. So how can we make, we're putting state money into various things. How can we decide what we should do for RIM and what we should do for CREP?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn, particularly at this point in time, I don't see much conversion of those riparian wooded lands. I mean, I'm certainly they're occurring. But right now, with the number of air-impaired waters that are continuing to be designated, I think the challenge we have is setting strong priorities and targeting the available dollars that we have and leveraging them to the maximum degree that we can to achieve those targeted outcomes. And is there a need in the future to look at those losses that are continuing to take place and try to come up with something for those? Maybe so, but at this point I'm not convinced that that is a significant issue, and certainly in comparison to restoring some of our impaired waters out there, I think it's a very, it, in my mind, would be a lower priority at this point in time.
Please continue. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Panis, you turn
the Representative Panis.
Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, the program costs, we have estimated them in working with USDA, is a total for the 100,000 acres of $226 million. USDA share is $180 million. The state share over the next two bonding cycles will be $46.4 million through December 2007, which is the end of the current farm bill. The state under this would be able to leverage $4 from the feds for every dollar spent by the state, which is a substantial benefit over what we had in the Minnesota River. The second generation CREP goals, sediment reduction in all three watersheds, and again this goes back to some of the earlier questions, give us a context for that and we will attempt to do that. But these are significant numbers, reducing phosphorus by 530,000 pounds per year, 45,000 acres of riparian buffers along some 2,000 linear miles of primarily streams, rivers, and ditches in those areas. Enrolling 6,500 acres of land in sensitive groundwater areas. These are wellhead protection or source water protection areas that have been delineated by the Department of Health in cooperation with the local public water supply utility, estimating that that could protect the water supplies for close to 250,000 people. Restores 30,000 acres of wetlands, and these are strategically located that would provide water, storage, and wildlife benefits, and increasing some base flow augmentation in certain parts of the state, particularly in the Red River, and establish 100,000 acres of wildlife habitat, in addition to the recreational and tourism alternate options that come along with that. Some examples. This is a picture of the Red River Valley. You can see the historic flooding that has occurred up there, and this isn't just something from a 97 flood. If you look at that neck of the woods, it has had a flood disaster declaration, I think, in 10 of the last 12 years. So certainly storage, buffers, levee setbacks, CREP can go a long ways to helping that. And I'll have a specific example a little bit later. This is the Root River entering the Mississippi. You can see the turbidity. And a lot of that comes from the tributary areas, and we believe that the buffers and strategic wetland restorations can have a significant impact on changing that. The South East has a TMDL that basically is turbidity and suspended solids, basically, and fecal coliform. And although we can't address the fecals with CREP, we certainly can deal with sediment. With these kinds of buffers that you see here, either along a natural stream or along a ditch system, as you see in the cutout photograph, are the kinds of things we're trying to achieve. Bureau of Wetland Restoration in Maurer County, along a ditch system that can store that water, provide for water quality benefits as well as flood storage benefits, plus the multitude of habitat that you get from it. Here's a sinkhole. Being able to buffer those, to be able to prevent or reduce the amount of sedimentation going into those. And I saw an interesting deal on Channel 2 the other day where, I can't remember the individual's name, but who's going through all these caves in southeastern Minnesota. And it's basically a result of this kind of thing, the establishment of those caves are a direct result of a lot of these sinkholes where it just dissolves the limestone and creates the caverns. In southwestern Minnesota, here are their priorities in terms of wellhead protection areas, strategic locations that they have prioritized for their areas. I don't know how well this shows up. This is an area of the Grand Marais River up in the northwestern part of the state in Polk County. One of the projects up there involves buffers along a stream and two wetland restorations. This kind of gives a perspective of what the local project work teams are looking at doing for this area. And just to give a quick idea of what CREP could mean to an area like this is, without a CREP, if we tried to use just CRP, our maximum would be somewhere about 150 to 180 feet on each side of the stream or ditch. There is a proposal for a special seeding strategy that could extend that up to 300. But under CREP, we have the flexibility to define what that is in cooperation with USDA. So we would look at the ability to put this entire area in CREP and set it aside long term, permanently, if that was the desire of the landowners and the watershed district up there. But we believe that the potential savings to the state and local governments just on this portion of the project is about $175,000. And without having a CREP, those state and local costs would be higher. This is a flood control project. I would envision that the request would come through bonding through FDR if it wasn't covered under CREP, and the landowners would have to bear part of the assessments for paying the cost. And in my mind, it doesn't make a lot of sense to do that when we've got a capability to leverage the federal funds to achieve that objective. If we look at the specifics now, the Red River, how do you distribute those acres in each one of these areas? The focus is flood damage reduction. Riparian zones, take those highly prone lands out of production, or areas where they put up setback levees to help confine the flows and protect the agricultural land, 25,500 acres. Wetland restorations, which would provide flood storage in addition to the wetland restoration, 17,000 acres. And these would be done on a very strategic fashion. We have 9 flood damage reduction work teams in the Red River Valley for each major watershed. And those project work teams would set the priorities and adopt specific projects. This would not have eligibility just to every citizen and every landowner up there. It's targeted specifically to those projects. In the southeast, riparian zones, recognizing we're trying to achieve some of the significant water quality benefits for their areas, would be targeted for buffers. Groundwater protection, they have identified some specific priorities for source water protection, wellhead protection. Highly erodible land, the southeast is still very steep, and there would be some strategic areas where land would be taken out of production because of their high risk to erosion and sedimentation. We have a unique element in here which is not requires specific approval from USDA, but we believe that by reintroducing grass rotation, which has been lost since we've had a reduction in animal agriculture, particularly dairy in that neck of the woods, can significantly reduce erosion and sedimentation and build soil quality. So we've looked at a small number to kind of demonstrate that in this particular part of the state. And wetland restorations, almost 9,000 acres, again, those are perpetual only. In the southwest, 9,000 acres for riparian. Again, I showed you the picture on wellhead groundwater protection of 1,500 acres and wetland restorations of 4,500, and that constitutes the 100,000 acres that we have. The easement options for highly erodible land, contour strips, I could talk about 15-year CRP with some CREP incentives that provides a greater incentive for landowners to participate. These critical areas, 35-year or permanent rim easements in the governor's proposal at the landowner's choice. Riparian areas, buffers, 35-year or perpetual easement, again, at the landowner's choice. Wetland restorations are permanent only. And groundwater protection, again, 35-year or perpetual at the landowner's choice. We've included some other things within the context of the governor's application from issues that have been raised over the last four years.
There was a footnote on that last slide, something about 120 acres.
Mr. Chairman, sorry I missed that. One of the issues that was raised in the Minnesota River, the feeling by some groups that we took too large of areas into CREP, even though everybody, FSA and the Bowser process approved those. We have at least initially agreed that if a easement was going to exceed 120 acres, there would have to be additional review and approval by the local FSA and SWCD committees. That number could be lowered. There have been some discussions in our negotiations to find some common ground on issues where that might be less.
Rep. Sandil.
Mr. Chairman, Director Harnack, could you go over the public access to CREP lands? Give me just a brief description of how the public, hunter, walker, birders, hikers, could have access to this land.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dill, there's basically two ways, and I give some examples in the Minnesota River with CREP. Is, and I use my experiences as well. I go out and I contact a landowner, ask for permission, and they give you permission to hunt on the land. And of about the 20, 22 people I've asked, I've been denied by one, and that was because it was a remote site and preferred people not to walk across a fenced area. The other way is you'll see along the Minnesota River itself that there are some sites where the county has provided some parking spaces that can overview the Minnesota River and some of the CREP sites for viewing. But the landowner controls access and egress. The CREP nor RIM provides specific authorization for trespassing for any purpose. And that has been an issue over the years in some from some people's perspectives, but landowners want to maintain control of their land, particularly when there are areas that are dispersed throughout the rest of their operation that free access would probably limit our ability to secure some of these critical areas.
Thank you.
Representative McNamara?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Harnack, there's been a lot of discussion about permanent and the temporary easements, and I thought I picked up, what did you say the board's experience has been in the Minnesota River Valley on the permanent and the participation there?
Okay. Mr. Chairman and Representative McNamara, and we need to be cautious of comparing the Minnesota River with these two new creeks. And just a little history on that is when Governor Carlson proposed back then, it was a result of a citizens group recommendation that 190,000 acres should be set aside permanently in the Minnesota River Basin. Governor Carlson proposed permanent. The legislature said permanent shall be given preference when it was funded. There was also a significant payment incentive for permanent over any other option. And therefore, people gobbled up the permanent easements. There were very, very few. I think 1,500 acres out of the 100,000 that were not. And we're in a different kind of a setting for these CRIPs. The governor has not indicated that there would be a particular preference for it, but left it to the discretion of the landowner to choose between the 35 and permanent that is being offered, except wetland restorations are required to be permanent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Director Harnack, it's a voluntary program. The farmers certainly have an opportunity to participate permanently, voluntarily. We're not requiring them. It's a voluntary program for them to step forward and say these highly erodible lands, which I would argue definitely should not be farmed today, they should not be farmed ever, that they should be permanent. It's an opportunity for them to step forward, same as it was in the Minnesota River. In our local rivers in my county, they can step forward voluntarily and participate in this program. We're not making them do it permanently.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, no, the landowners have those two choices. They can choose a 35-year easement on top of the 15-year contract, or they can choose a permanent easement. And there is no incentive payment on those. We asked Steve Taft from the University of Minnesota to give us a payment schedule that's based on the value of the land. And just a rough example would be in a particular county, if a permanent easement went for $375, a 20 or a 35-year easement would go for about $3.25. So about a $50 difference between the two. So we are not incenting it, but certainly landowners have the choice to pick and choose.
Representative Harnack, we have about 5 minutes left. If you could maybe finish with your slides, and then we'll go back to questions.
Mr. Chairman, just right on that.
Representative Kahn?
Can anybody give me one economic reason to not give an incentive for the permanent easement?
I think, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I think you can have a number of different organizations can sit up here in front of you and give you their perspective.
I don't want the philosophical reason. I want an economic reason.
I believe, personally and from a program perspective, that if we believe these are critical areas, that the state should get the best buy for its buck, and we should have permanent on the table. That said, over the course of the next several weeks, discussions will continue, and hopefully there will be some agreement on some common ground to move forward. The status of CREP right now is USDA is basically delaying approval of our application, hoping for the state and the interests to achieve some greater consensus. I don't believe we're going to achieve agreement I think, of all parties. But we've moved a lot closer than we were at the beginning. And I'm optimistic that through these discussions we have here at the legislature and continued discussions between the Gov's office, the interest groups, that we will find something that can effectively move forward and provide this significant conservation benefit for the state of Minnesota. In summary, CREP is the centerpiece of the Gov's Clean Water Initiative. I believe the governor's application provides a fair and flexible options that allows landowners a choice. There's a significant opportunity here to leverage federal dollars to achieve our mutual priority goals for the state, locals, and federal government. CREP is voluntary. People can choose to participate or not, and we've got very significant natural resource benefits from it. Water quality, sediment reduction, flood damage reduction, and significant wildlife and recreational benefits for the state.
Mr. Harnack, I thank you very much for your presentation. I think you covered things quite well. Your previous slide, though, stated that there were several meetings were held and facilitated by the Bureau of Mediation Services and staff in order to achieve consensus over the issues. Can you give us kind of a status as to where we're at right now with those discussions?
Mr. Chairman, there are still discussions going on. On the issues that were raised, and it wasn't just permanent easements. And I think that, you know, there were some issues like the size of the parcel that's taken. There were some concerns about what happens if land goes tax forfeiture. There were some issues regarding just local priority and local flexibility in it. There were some issues over constitutionality that have been raised. And I think we've addressed all those other issues. And the one that remains is coming to a middle ground, if you will, or on the issue of how much is permanent and how much is not permanent.
Thank you very much for your presentation. We'll be looking forward to the issue in the form of a bill later on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. If you have any further questions, don't hesitate to call.
Does that conclude everything that you have in your package?
Mr. Chairman, that concludes the governor's recommendations, those two proposals.
Okay. Not everything in your package, though. Members, tomorrow we're going to have the zoo will be here for their presentation, Minnesota Zoo. So we're going to need to start right on time, I encourage you to maybe bring your cameras along. I have experiences in the past as when they bring their critters in to kind of show us. It's really kind of fun.
Nothing scary.
Well, in your case, we'll make an exception. I hope you don't scare the animals.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.